Robin, how are you?
I am good, Linda. How are you doing? It's good to see you. Good to see you, quote unquote.
Yeah, it is good to see you. But I love it. I love this format. Yes. You know what I'm saying? Virtual for me is 100% of my time, and working with my students and having meetings, and I love it. I really do love it. I know some people don't, but I think it's great.
I think it's great to talk to people and to see sort of what they prefer. And I think you sort of have everyone that is sort of like shifting into their, you know, mode of work.
Yes.
And, you know, you know, from home, in the office, a little bit of both. So it's great.
It was a bit of confusing at the beginning. I couldn't figure out where I was supposed to be. Should I be at work? Can I work from home? Whatever. So it is a crazy time.
It's true. Anyway,
we have just a terrific guest with us today. Yes. We are very, very fortunate. He has an extremely busy schedule. So thank you so much for joining us today. We're really excited, Rob. Rob Westerfeld plays a huge role here at Lindenwood University, and it became even bigger recently. He is Vice President of Strategy and Innovation, and we're going to talk to him a little bit about that role here at Lindenwood University in a couple minutes. And he also now took on another role as Interim Senior Vice President of Enrollment and Student Engagement. So welcome, Rob.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We are really excited to have you here. You know, the main reason why we asked Rob to join us today, he is so knowledgeable on jobs to be done theory. And that was really new for me. And I just thought everyone could benefit from an understanding of that idea. But before we dig into that, I would love our listeners to learn a little bit more about who you are. Can you share your educational journey with everyone, and how'd you get here, right where you are today?
You know, it's a interesting journey, and I often will run across students I meet who ask me this question, I want to do what you do. How do I get there? And the truth is, I never imagined I would be doing what I'm doing. Actually, at any point in my career, especially in higher ed, I never envisioned myself getting into higher ed or getting into these various fields. So it all started in the mid to late 90s. And I was in Southern California, and I had a roommate. And at that time, the California housing market hit its low. And there was at the university I was at, across the street, there was a house for sale for $120,000, if you can imagine that. And my friend said, we should go in and buy this house together. And I said, I was a grad student. I said, well, there's no way. I can't buy a house. I don't have a job. And he said, well, what do you do? So my background, I was a student athlete, and I got a full scholarship to play football at a school called Weber State University in Ogden, Utah. So I went from there to graduate school. I studied business and communication, and I was planning to go to law school, and then I switched at the last at the end and decided to study philosophy at the master's level. I got into philosophical thinking and ended up going to graduate school to study philosophy. That's where I met my roommate, who asked me this question. And it turned out to be a really good combination, because, you know, Alvin Plantinga, who's a famous philosopher, once described philosophy as just thinking really hard. And so applying that to the discipline I'm in has been really invaluable. But going back to how I got to this point, essentially, he said, well, what do you do? And I said, well, all of my background has been in PR and marketing. And he goes, oh, well, there's an opening at the university in the marketing department. And I was like astonished. I said, the university has a marketing department? It never occurred to me. And the title was university editor. And so this was December. I decided I was doing two master's degrees. I decided I'm just going to stop. I'm going to go get a job. And that's what I did. And so I got that job. And the role I was playing was, I was the editor of the university magazine, and then I also was doing all the copywriting for advertising. Well, I took to it really quick. And then I became PR director. Then I became advertising director. And then I became head of basically brand marketing. And I was overseeing all of the university marketing, advertising especially. And I started asking the question, like, how do we know if any of this is working? And I went from the creative side to the analytical side. And that's where everything changed for me. Now, I will say this is so when people ask me, how did you get to where you're going? It's I always had my head down and I studied my craft. And I found out that most of my colleagues, they stopped doing that after they graduated. And I actually ramped up. I studied way more outside of school than I did even in school. And what I was fortunate to have is I would be studying these areas, but then I was able to apply it. So the application of the knowledge then gave me the experiential knowledge. And then pretty soon I was taking off. So it got to the point one time where I worked in a marketing department where the bosses, it was more of an agency model. And the boss would always, her gotcha statement to everybody, because we had a decentralized budget. So we basically were functioning like an agency. Her gotcha was, so what's your marketing plan? And of course, you know, these academics are like, I don't have a marketing plan. So her thing was like, well, then we'll tell you what you're going to do. And then one day I said, well, what's our marketing plan? And she was like, well, we don't really have one. And so right? And so it was just one thing after another. Pretty soon I became an expert. And then I got the opportunity to go to another university and do this, take all these ideas I had and really start from the ground up. And so I worked for 10 years at that one university in Southern California. Then I went to Oregon, worked for 12 years, but I was progressively taking on more. So I took on enrollment, I took on HR, IT, legal. And so I started getting all of these learning opportunities. But again, I was learning and applying. And then eventually, as you're going along, you learn about innovation because innovation is really about transformative change. Strategy is also about transformative change. So along the way, I decided I was being offered the opportunity to get a paid for a doctorate. And I decided I don't really like to be told what to learn. So I always, you know, I'm not really into structured, formalized education because there's certain things I'm really interested in. And then when I learn the part I'm interested in, I'm ready to move on to the next thing I'm interested in. But then I just said, you know what? I want to get more formal education in innovation. And so I just looked around and I noticed that Stanford had innovation entrepreneurship certificate, professional certificate through a joint venture with College of Business and the College of Engineering tied to the design school at Stanford. So I looked at that. Every course I saw, I was interested in. And it would allow me to continue to work while I was going. And I loved it. And I told people, so I chose that. Now this will get into the discussion we'll have. I was like, now imagine this. I chose a certificate that they paid for, which was obviously a lot cheaper than a doctorate. I chose the Stanford certificate over a doctoral program. Now your doctoral program didn't exist at the time. But
yes, because I know you would have chosen ours.
So I want to make that caveat.
You would have chosen this because it is right. Different. I know you would have.
It's very different. So anyway, but that kind of, so I had evolved into my previous role as the chief strategy officer at the university. And I was in the process of designing the University of the Future. And I created this concept called the Sandbox College, which we can talk about another time. But then during the pandemic, I get this solicitation from somebody about this opening here. And it caught my eye because I thought, what kind of person is opening up a role like this at a time like this? And that's how I learned about Linda Wood.
My gosh.
Wow, that's wonderful. You know, I love the description of your journey. And you know what it makes me think of is it makes me think, and this is a conversation that Linda and I've had many times, the purpose of education. Right? What is the purpose of education? And I wonder if on your journey, especially because you've been involved in higher education from times when it seems like it was such a different time of higher education, you know, of what the, maybe the purpose of education was, maybe not, you know, with what your opinion is. But I guess I would say, what do you think is, what would you say is the purpose of higher education? And has that shifted in your time and in your journey? And how do you, and I love your, what you're saying about you're applying, like you're constantly researching and you're applying and what you're learning and you're applying to that. But I would just love to know just how it, do you think the purpose has shifted, and how do you apply that with your role?
Yes. If at all? Oh, that's a great question. This is something I've thought a lot about. I've had a lot of rigorous debate with people over the years, especially academics, about this. Here's what I think is the purpose of education and how that purpose has actually gone back to its original intention. I think we had an original intention, if we go way back to the Greeks, of what this sort of concept of, let's say, liberal arts is, higher education. And where it went, and then how it's come back to its original purpose. So, you know, if you think about the definition of liberal arts as the Greeks understood it, was that which makes a person more free. And it was free people who were educated, and they were educated to run the polis, right? Then over time, it gets subjectivized, it takes on its own identity, and all of a sudden, it's not about making people more free. It's about individual disciplines, right? Now I think it's gone back to the original. This is what I've always loved about education, is that education properly understood and executed makes a person more free, not less free. Now, I think we have instances of both, and we have some people in some education that's actually enslaving people. It's saddling them with debt with an education that does not make them more free. So at Lindenwood, we're definitely not about that kind of education. And so when you look at our strategy, learner needs and expectations are right at the center of our strategy. We're adapting, building, and engaging around those needs and expectations. But it's with this idea of how do we make an individual more free in today's society so that they can contribute and make the world a better place. So that's what I'm all about. And I think that the trajectory of education is bouncing out of that subjectivized, weird idea of what a liberal arts education, like I used to ask provosts, faculty all the time, define the liberal arts for me. And the best they could ever do was some vague notion of well-roundedness. And I would say, you tell me who are the well-rounded people who are making the decisions about this well-rounded education. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't. But if we went back to the Greeks and just say, whatever it is, it better make them more free in today's world. Mm.
I love that. I love the discussion of freedom with that being involved with the education that you are getting, you know? I think that's excellent. And I think that's very well applied. And I love, too, the discussion of sort of where we were. And maybe it has evolved into not so much about that anymore, but maybe coming back to that too, even post-pandemic. Do you feel that maybe the pandemic was a part of that timeline? That did that bring us back to that wanting to be free when we're getting our education, as sort of a strive to, when we educate ourselves, is being educated in a sense that when we are, education will bring us to a sense of freedom. Do you think the pandemic sort of sparked that, to bringing us back to where we are today?
I haven't really thought about it from the freedom perspective in the pandemic, but now that you mention it, that's very interesting. I think what the pandemic did was accelerate the cracks widening. Yeah. So if you think pre-pandemic, there was already cracks forming. You look at the, you know, $1.4, $1.5, $6 billion worth of student loan debt. That's significant, right? So when you go back before the pandemic, you already had these ideas of, like, you know, there's a lot going wrong in higher education. We saw this, like, it's not anticipating, we'll get into this obviously in innovation, anticipating what students need and delivering it when and how they need it. So we had some issues before. Then the pandemic hits. Now all of a sudden, it's accelerating these issues, right? And so I think what's going on now, so if you go back in history, both the right and the left are guilty in this whole issue of the Higher Education Act, which is this idea of funding higher education. So you look at 65 and 71, all of a sudden you can get loans and go get education, and there's no qualification for those loans at all.
Right.
Okay. You just need to be admitted to an institution and the money flows. You look at college enrollment after the Higher Education Act, it just starts going like this. Well, these institutions get ramped up, built up. Now I can just offer whatever the heck I want because the money's flowing. So I always say money covers a multitude of sins within higher education. As long as there's black, all the redness is covered, right? Well, that starts to wane, right? Because now we've kind of hit peak saturation in that old model and paradigm. And now the tide's going out. And now all of a sudden everybody's scrutinized and say, well, what actually happens to me after I go through this process? And for the first time in history, you're seeing a majority of young people saying, I don't believe college is worth it. And you're like, that's a problem. But why are they saying that? Because they're saying, I'm curious to know what you guys think about this, but I have asked, this is kind of like an ongoing sort of informal research project for me. And I will ask people, what percentage of your college education was a complete waste of your time? Hmm. Nobody to this point has said zero. They all do this. They all start doing a calculation. And you're like, okay, that's wrong. Because that tells us something about what we're producing and what it's doing for the person we're producing it for. So I think what the pandemic did is it accelerated these issues and brought them to the fore. And now look at the explosion of innovation that's happening as a result. We've been disrupted because now our business model is totally, you know, got cracks and crevices all over it. Right. We're maxed out on the discount. The number of students is going down. You're losing your levers, and now you have to produce value at every stage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's true. Absolutely. You know, I did read somewhere, and I thought this was just, I wish I could remember where I read it, but that approximately 80% of individuals never use the degree that they originally received.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, that's just staggering. I mean, that's just staggering because that's a very expensive purchase that you leave sitting on the shelf somewhere.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Well, now I would say yes, and that there's definitely truth to, you know, some people just having wasted their time. Because the reality is there's this myth that everybody needs to go to college. And now everybody knows that that's a myth. Mm-hmm. Now, but we ran the last 25 years as if that was just a fact. Mm-hmm. Now, it is true that people who go to college, if you look at averages, do really well. But there is a segment of the population that doesn't do well because we have the stopout rate. I mean, another 80% statistic is people change their majors. 80% are changing their majors, you know, within the course of their degree, and there's added expense to that.
Right.
But I will say this, it depends. Education is not a monolithic thing. And when we talk about education, even when we talk about the faculty, we talk about them in monolithic terms as if faculty are faculty. Well, they're not. They're individuals. They have different views and philosophies and things of that nature. Same with education. So it could be the case, like let's just take a liberal arts college that just does a liberal arts degree.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there is no liberal arts job outside of teaching liberal arts, but it's not that you're not applying the liberal arts to your profession. So you got a lot of research too that says people are starting to hire liberal arts students because of their cognitive capability and their rigor. And this goes back to this liberal arts discussion. I had a conversation with a provost one time about why this liberal arts package, shouldn't we add coding to the liberal arts? Shouldn't we add Excel mathematics, the mathematics of Excel to our, I mean, the universe is run right now on, or the universe, the world is run on spreadsheets. Why is that not, you know, taught to every student? Or why isn't every student taking a business class since they are going to work for a business, whether it's for-profit or non-for-profit? And her response at the time was, well, those are professional endeavors. And I was like, well, let's go back to the Greeks. Was building a professional endeavor? Then why was it part of the curriculum, geometry and all these things? Mm-hmm. That was so that people could build buildings that had curvatures and columns and things like that, right? Mm-hmm. And again, but they had the mindset of, we need everybody to have the education that makes them more free. And I think that's where you start. You start with what will make people more free in today's world. And if you want to be more free in today's world and you understand the language of computation, you can do things that other people who don't have that language understanding can't.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I wonder, I used to always talk about in class, the Starbucks effect, right? As soon as you could walk into Starbucks and get exactly what you wanted when you wanted it, no matter who you were. And then to top it off, I know who you are. I know your name. I know when you normally come in. I can anticipate. That's the beauty. And I think that's the beauty, is that I can anticipate when you're going to pull up. I see you. I know exactly what you want. I can talk to you. I can say, oh, hey, Rob, you want a caramel macchiato today with this and this and this and this in it? And
yeah.
That's a great feeling, right? That's a great feeling. So am I selling coffee? You better believe it. But I'm selling the experience that I just gave you that you know, matches anything else. And so I think once we had that, and then of course Apple and the iPhone, you get, you know, in my day, you put in the eight track and you have to wait, you know what I mean? Till that song came around. There is no waiting anymore. There is no waiting.
Okay. So do you want to jump into jobs to be done?
Let's jump into it. Like, sorry. We could talk all day.
I mean, we might as well, because this is a great transition.
Yeah.
I mean,
let's do it.
If people, I don't know if you guys have read Howard Schultz's book, Onward.
Yes, I did. Yeah, I used to work for Starbucks because I love the company. I made them hire me. Yeah, for 3 months. I was like,
oh, that's great.
I wanted them because they have an awesome educational program, which is so cool. So anyway, yes, I read a story.
Let's use these two examples you just gave and talk about jobs theory. And maybe we'll back up for a second and we'll get to that, because when you think about Clayton Christensen and his approach, he says that at Harvard Business School, they committed the most grievous sin by teaching their students that the customer was at the center of basically the business strategy, which, you know, strikes people as like, what are you talking about? Isn't that like obvious? And he's like, no. In fact, that's why businesses are failing. He says, what's at the center of the decision-making process is the job to be done. Because what we know is that people have jobs. There's no segment. He says, he gives an example. The milkshake example, right? The milkshake dilemma. He says, you tell me what the customer segment is for a milkshake. He goes, who likes milkshakes? Because all kinds of people like milkshakes.
Yeah.
So there is no customer at the center of that. What there is a job to be done. And so getting back to Starbucks, you know, what's the customer segment for coffee? You know, it's like, well, everybody.
Everyone.
Right? I was going to say, my children love Starbucks.
Yes. Yay. No. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So you're like, okay, so if the customer's at the center, how do you form a strategy around that? And so what he says is, well, the job is at the center. What is the job? And Howard Schultz had the insight to say there's a place between work and home that is missing. That is a job that these people need done. Because people thought, you're crazy. You can buy coffee so cheap. You can make coffee yourself, all this stuff. And he says, yeah, but you can't get really good coffee in an environment that gives you an experience where you feel like you have a place between home and work.
Exactly.
And that's the job that we're filling.
That's exactly. It's right. It's no longer, you know, Right. Yes. Do they have great coffee? Yeah, but I can go somewhere else and get great coffee too.
You can buy their coffee and make it yourself.
Well, right? I can. Oh no! But no, 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 no. Well, you know.
If you remember from the book, there were some problems that emerged after he left, right? And they started cooking food. The smell started changing to burnt cheese. They got these new espresso machines that were super tall. You couldn't see the barista anymore. And then all of a sudden the experience started changing and Starbucks started to decline because they started focusing on other things, not the job. Well, the job was, I go there exactly for the reasons you described. I meet the barista. The barista says hello to me. So-and-so's name. They put it on a cup. Now I can't even see the barista. Now they can't see me walk in. Now I used to smell coffee when I came in. Now I smell burnt cheese. And so he's like, this is not Starbucks. And then he comes back and he says, get rid of those machines. Remember, they got rid of sandwiches and cooking food for a while. And then they actually got companies to create specialized cooking machines that would not burn anything because they were at a certain temperature. You know, it's all this crazy stuff.
Well, right. Because it's
so how do you apply job to be done to Lindenwood?
Yeah. So, I mean, when you think about the learner, now we use that word specifically. We don't say student. We say learner. Okay. Because we think, what are the jobs to be done going forward?
Yeah.
Well, we're coming out of an era of episodic education, which is, here's what you do. You come for 4 years, you graduate, and you become well off in your life, right? Now, that was fine in a world that didn't change very frequently, right? So if you look at the rate of adoption of technology, it's like, look at a personal computer, takes like 16 years before a quarter of the population gets a personal computer or something like that. Now you look at the rate of adoption of something and it's months, right? It's no longer years. So when you look at disruption used to only happen in certain segments of our world. And so we could handle the disruption. You know, now you look at something, let's go back to Apple now. So you think about, let's just say the iPod, and you think, now, Steve Jobs was not a big believer in market research at all. In fact, he said it biased you. It didn't give you real information. And what his real superpower was, is jobs to be done. And he said, I have jobs to be done that I think if I do them and I'm satisfied with it, the rest of the world will love it because they're like me. Okay. And he thought of himself. So he said, if you remember, he's like, I love music. I have a huge music collection. He's a big Bob Dylan fan, right? And he said, but the problem is I can't access it when I want. So I have this job to be done. And he said, I have a job. I want 1,000 songs in my pocket. Mm-hmm. And he created the iPhone. Okay. There was no market. He didn't say, and you know who's going to love it? 14 to 18 year old kids, right?
Right.
Turns out everybody had that problem. And he said, once I solve this problem, everybody's going to want one. Take that a step further in 2007. And you say, okay, 1,000 jobs done in your pocket, or 10,000 or 100,000, right? I'm going to create a device that gets you what you need, when and how you need it. And everybody in the world is going to buy it. Now, nobody believed that he would sell like a billion of, I mean, I forgot how many billions it is. And now Apple is like the most valuable company in the entire world. But it's because they focused on the job to be done. And so you look at the adoption rate of the iPhone itself, it was like 2.75 years. When you look at the ramping up of information explosion at that point, they started measuring information in zettabytes. And then you have this quote from IBM in 2012 that says, 90% of all the information that was ever created in the existence of humanity was created in the last 2 years. That was in 2012. Now we're way past that.
Right.
So
right.
Now, going back to higher education, we're in a situation where information is ubiquitous. I don't have an information problem. I don't need a professor to tell me something. In fact, I'll fact check the professor.
Right. Thank you.
So
right.
How does this change higher ed? We're not information providers, we're transformational institutions. Because now the problem isn't information, it's the culling and the packaging and delivery of information so that it can be applicable to the individual. And that's where you get into personalized education. Mm-hmm. They're like, help me wade through this to get to where I need to be. And that's where we get back to the freedom, right? They're being enamored with information. And now we're going to say, we're going to help you to get from where you are to where you want to be by getting you what you need, when and how you need it.
Exactly. Which is what they expect.
That's what they expect. That's why when you look at your iPhone, yes, the home screen.
Yes.
The people who are on that home screen, the businesses, they're meeting the job to be done. That's why they're on the home screen and not on the second or third screen.
Yeah. See?
And so our job should be to get onto the home screen of the iPhone, right?
Guess I love what? That.
New statistic, 88% of all U.S. teens have an iPhone, not just a smartphone, but an iPhone. That's market saturation. Now, here's an interesting fact about that. The majority of enterprise software development is not in the iOS system. So you got a whole generation of millions of people coming up who are going to go to work and say the systems here are not iOS systems. They are, you know, Android or PC. And they're going to be like, hey, I live in a world where all my iOS stuff is my halo around my entire life. I expect my work to be this way. Mm-hmm. And then there's going to be an explosion of iOS developers for enterprise systems.
I believe that. That's so interesting, right?
That's fantastic. No, that's great.
Yeah,
that's
so we're just brushing the surface. I know I want to be cognizant of our time, but I mean, sure. There's you brought up those two examples, and I was like, wow, that's right on.
No, that's what it's all about, and it's like I think the issue becomes this behemoth. You know, any institution, right? I mean, boy, you want it to be dynamic and flexible and can shift, you know, but it's like, oh my gosh. You know, we have a lot of cracks due to the pandemic, right? And I think about K-12 and all the cracks. And, but how do you change? How can you change the culture, the current culture? You know what I'm saying? To be more dynamic, to be open to this, you know, hey, we have to think differently to do differently. My mentor, gosh, that was his favorite phrase. You have to think differently to do differently. Yeah. And how does that evolution happen? I mean, because we need it today. We need that mindset today to create the student experience so that they can be successful and an experience that they're looking for, that they really expect. How do you do that? It's a big deal.
I think disruption forces in industry to do that, right? So when we didn't have the disruptive elements, we could be status quo. And well, that's what we've been, because if you look at the millennials, right? So we had a dip back in the 70s when Gen X came through. Gen X is the smallest generation. And during that period of time, there was a lot of innovation that happened in the early 80s. But then when the millennial swing came up and it was the biggest college-bound generation, oh my gosh, so much money flowed into higher ed. So many bad ideas were funded. And then when the tide receded, we started seeing like, oh my gosh. Now compound that with, as I was talking about earlier, disruption in every sector of our lives. It wasn't just one sector. It was every sector. It was continuous. And then what we are starting to awaken to, it's not going away.
Right.
The disruption's not going to level out. In fact, it's going to speed up. And that's why Clayton Christensen, you know, mentioning him again, predicted that, what was it? Half of schools or something like that were going to go out of business in the next decade. Mm-hmm. Because they're not going to be able to pivot and respond in the time that they need to. So disruption will do that. The other thing is, look, there's been books written about this. It's not rocket science. Mm-hmm. It's, culture of discipline. Disciplined people, the right people with the right experience who are disciplined. Disciplined thought and then disciplined action. in the last 20 years, we haven't had those three elements consistently in higher ed. And so there's a big unwinding that is occurring as a result.
Yeah, it's interesting, that unwinding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's fantastic. And it's fantastic to see it applied in higher education. I think you see so many businesses, which, you know, I'm sure every business around the country would love to have you, Rob, right now. So we are so thankful to have you here. You know, just so many businesses that you're hearing are, I think we're hoping when the pandemic ended, like, now we can go back to the way it was.
Yeah.
Restaurants, I think, are a huge example of just...
Yeah.
And we love our restaurants, right? And, you know, that we want them to be able to be successful, and they are really having to do a major mind shift of how can we succeed in this new environment of just really rethinking. So it's really exciting to hear the way that you are thinking of our strategy. And as you're saying, like, it's really just, you know, thinking about the learner and thinking about the best education in the world that we are today. You know, it's, you know, it's not necessarily anything new. It's just, you know, making sure that we are providing what is needed in this new environment, you know. But I think that we're able to do it in a way that I think it might be a little bit more challenging for businesses that have been operating. You know, I think in education, we're sort of used to change. You know, now, are we always willing to change? I don't know about that, but I think we're sort of used to change.
I don't think I agree with you on that last point, only because what we think of change is tweaking a course.
Right? Tweaking. That's a really good word. Yeah.
When you look at how long it takes just to do something that simple, versus the rate of change that we experience in our everyday lives, where things come into existence in the billions and go out of existence from the billions, it's stark. And if you go back to jobs to be done, now, if you look at our strategy, it's not, the learner isn't at the center. The learner needs an expectation. So that's another way of saying the jobs to be done that the learner has. And then going back and saying, how do we become, and this comes from Christensen and that book, Competing Against Luck, how do you become a purpose brand where your brand is associated with the job to be done? Those schools that can do that will win, and they are winning very big right now. And so if you think of a purpose brand, it's like IKEA. IKEA solves a job to be done. Help me furnish my office or my apartment today.
Yeah.
As soon as we have that job, we go to IKEA. IKEA is associated with that. So we need to think about that with Lindenwood. Oh, I need this Lindenwood, right? And
yeah.
So
yeah.
And we're getting there, but
right.
We need to move faster.
I love that question.
I love to think about that. Like, I already have ideas in my head that I love. And it's the same with the strategy too. Like when I'm like with engagement, you know, I think about that, you know, when we are like, just we went to a conference last week, because I was like, oh my gosh, we should do this because it's a great way to engage, you know? So I love to think about things in that way. And so, you know, now when you have that question, it's like, okay, what is the job to be done? Like what, how can I approach that? You know, what can I do? What do my, like, what is the job to be done in this class, in my college, you know, in my work? So I love that.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, Christensen makes a point to say, when you have an issue or a problem, you look at the bookshelf of theories, because jobs to be done is a theory. And you want to make sure you match the theory to the problem. Now, what's great about jobs to be done is it has explanatory power. It can make sense of a lot of why things happen the way they happen. That's why it's so powerful. And interestingly enough, I think it just hasn't been communicated very well, because it hasn't gotten the traction I believe it deserves. Partly that might be just Christensen's not, he wasn't the most dynamic communicator. But I think it's critical that we look through at everything through the lens of the jobs to be done, and not through things like Simon Sinek. You know, like Simon Sinek's
The Why.
Grand Theory of the Why is one of the worst theories I've ever seen. It has zero substantiation and has caused numerous people to be completely misled. And he doesn't even use that theory himself. So, you know, but you look at these, and sorry, I just rail against Simon Sinek's theory. I think people should just burn that book, start with why. The reason why I bring that up is that we get so fixated on these grand theories, and then we burn time we don't have trying to make them work. And like Christian said, go to your theory bookshelf and match it with the problem that you have. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to creating products, jobs theory is probably the best theory we have.
That's awesome.
That's excellent. Excellent.
That's why the leadership EDD that we have created is so pertinent, I think, to right now.
That's a great soundbite to share with your students, our students. Yes.
I totally agree.
On theoretical frameworks.
No more. There has never been a time when educational leaders need to be creative problem solvers. There's no better time than today. Yes. And to use design thinking is just simply a tool. You know what I'm saying? But it's the creative problem solving that needs to occur to get education, you know, to that next level, to get it where it needs to go. Mm-hmm. And those are the skills that, and the knowledge set that our students will have when they walk across that stage.
So think about this. You get paid to the degree of the difficulty of the problems you can solve, right? I forgot who said that, but they're basically saying, look, your value is relative to the difficulty of the problem that you can solve. So if you want to make people free in today's world, make them great problem solvers.
Yes. Now,
in addition to how you design thinking helps you to do that, jobs theory helps you to do that.
Right.
But then there's also interpersonal skills help you do that, because you can't solve problems by yourself. You mm-hmm. have to be able to work with other people. But that's why I think it's so great in your program that you make this a critical part, because people want to hire problem solvers. And if they have really thorny problems, your graduates are going to get really good paying jobs to go solve those problems, right?
That's what I say. Yeah. Well, hey.
And hence our graduate attribute, adaptable problem solvers.
There you go. spoken like director of general ed assessment. I love it.
Just throw that in there.
Well, this has been absolutely wonderful, Rob. We cannot thank you enough. I know how valuable your time is. And so we really appreciate you spending some time with us today.
Thank you for having me. This was really fun, and we'll have to do it again sometime.
Okay.
Wonderful. Thank you.
All right, have a great day.
There you go. See ya.
Bye.
Bye.